From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is a show where each week we deal with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit, finding balance in bringing things up to your conscious level so that the decisions you make and the behaviors you perform are more peaceful and have more integrity to them, and you feel more confident in who you are and what you're doing. So we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? Now, very often on the show, you've heard me talk about spiritual things, and I'm a mental health person. I'm a marriage and family therapist. I have a private practice, and yet, I often talk about spiritual things. And sometimes people ask me, you know, how does that all connect? And we're going to talk a little bit about that today because I actually have a marriage and family therapist as my guest today. And his name is Chuck Hillig. And he's written a number of books, actually. And his most recent one is one called Looking for God, Seeing the Whole, W-H-O-L-E, Seeing the Whole in One. And the book is actually so simply presented and yet very deep and profound. So I'm actually going to get right into today's show and introduce you to my guest, a marriage and family therapist since 1977, named Chuck Hillig. He was in the Navy for 3 years. And most interesting, he spent 7 years as a Los Angeles County probation officer, and we're going to talk about that also. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Hi, Stuart. Thanks so much for inviting me to hang out with you and your listeners for about an hour. I appreciate that.
Oh, it's my pleasure. There is the question that I posed just at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. You're a marriage and family therapist.
Right.
Why all this focus on spirituality if you're dealing with mental health issues?
Well, great question to start off with. I'm not sure that there's a real difference between those. I think that who we are really, truly is spirit inside in our heart of hearts, in the quintessence of who we are, and that is our spiritual path, for lack of a better term. And that's about love, but initially, before we can perhaps begin to walk down that path, we have to deal with a lot of psychological issues, which, of course, that is more often than not grounded in our fears.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people begin to address some of those fears and let those go and to deal with life on life's terms, it seems to create a space then for them to begin to deal with their spiritual issues and the spiritual quest, which is really the ultimate primordial question about who am I and what am I and why are we here and where are we going?
I was looking through an old, I was purging my filing cabinets. I have 5 of them in the last week, which means I've been taking a trip down memory lane. And I came across this old journal that I had with me when I was traveling to the former Soviet Union in the early 90s doing some AIDS work. Uh-huh. And I got real caught up. I know my ego got real caught up in, aren't I doing something wonderful? Look at me, type of thing. And in the middle of one of the trips, this thought came to me, and I wrote it down in the journal, and I hadn't realized it or thought of it since. And it says, I don't need what I am doing to give me my sense of identity. My sense of identity allows me to create what I am doing.
I like that.
I got chills when I read it again during the week, and I believe it's really a big piece of what your book is about. The first part of that statement was really about ego. And, you know, trying to it's like putting the cart before the horse, you know, trying to use the sense of identity and inform myself based on what I'm doing and impress other people with that, when the peace actually comes from knowing who I am and listening to that inner voice and deciding what path I'm taking in terms of what I'm doing in the world based on that peaceful place.
Right, right. I agree with that. I think that we need to discover, you know, what is in our heart of hearts,
mm-hmm.
and to act out of that space. Because if we don't, you know, we're going to be acting out of somebody else's definition of what they think we ought to do, and we're going to be aligning ourselves with something that's really quite false to who we are, and that's going to show up in how we live out our lives.
Like a lot of people who go into professions because the family expects them to, or because,
exactly.
you know, they felt it would make mom or dad or someone else happy, and they spent their lifetime unhappy until maybe they woke up in time to change course and find something they truly love doing.
Hopefully they would, and sometimes people never do, but sometimes
yeah.
they do. You know, as you and I both know, we've had clients that show up and they're in their 30s and 40s and realize that they've been really living somebody else's script,
mm-hmm.
doing what they thought other people would make them happy. And but that's really quite a sacrifice to make, because then if you're living your life for somebody else, what happens to you? What happens to your truth?
And your contribution then, not meaning you, but that person's contribution then to the world is actually a darker place.
Yes.
And adding to the unhappiness and the misfortunes of the world, because they're not engaging from a place of joy in their passion.
Yeah, and I'm a great believer in this whole truth-telling thing, and I'm glad that you've named your program Tell the Truth Faster, because you're right, the truth will set you free, but too often we get caught in this idea that, you know, that Jack Nicholson line, you know, you can't handle the truth.
Uh-huh.
But that really is a discount of the person that we're talking to.
Right.
And we're really trying to cop out and saying, I don't have the courage to be in my truth and to share that truth with you, and I'm going to use my finger pointing at you saying you can't handle it as a justification for my not having that courage.
Mm-hmm. And the truth very often is the difference. Even my opening quote, you know, it's determining what is the ego mind telling you to do and what is spirit or your heart telling you to do, and the truth is what comes from the spirit or heart space, not the ego.
Yes.
In fact, you had a quote that I actually laughed so hard when I read it that I actually called two friends to read it to them. And it says, ego is just software that likes to believe that it's hardware.
Yeah, yeah, I love that too. I don't, you know, that just came to me. It bubbled up to the surface of my awareness one day, and I said, that's kind of cute. I have to write that down and put that in someplace.
It was perfect. It like brings into today's world, in technological words that all of us can relate to, something that is the core of what every spiritual path is saying.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read it again. Ego is just software that likes to believe that it's hardware.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it, and I still
Thank
get
you.
A chuckle out of it.
Now,
I want to remind my callers that this is a live show today,
right.
and you can call in with some questions for either Chuck Illig or myself, or if you want to express your opinion on what we're talking about, the number is 480-949-1310. That's in the Phoenix area, 480-949-1310. And if you're listening from outside the Phoenix area via the Internet, it's the same number, 480-949-1310. 1310. Now, Chuck, let's get to the book that I read directly. It says, the title of the book is Looking for God, Seeing the Whole in One, W-H-O-L-E.
Right.
But in the center of the book is a H-O-L-E that actually, I guess it's about an inch in diameter and goes all the way through to the back of the book. So you actually seeing whatever's on the other side of the book. What's the purpose of that whole? What statement are you trying to make with that?
Well, I think it makes a little bit more sense if people can, if they're on the Internet, they can take a look at what the cover is. Because on the cover, I've got this very well-known picture of Michelangelo's The Sistine Chapel, and there's God the Father bearded, and he's touching fingertips with Adam. But I digitally separated those pictures, those images, and about an inch, and that's where I drilled the hole. So on the cover of the book, Both God and Adam are pointing equally to this void, this emptiness inside. So I wanted to kind of leapfrog over this idea that we have of what God should be. And I like to point out that there's really this emptiness that all things kind of have their matrix in, their origin in, and everything arises out of this void.
Okay, so and as you go through the book, I mean, one of the ways that I like to describe this book, I had Mark Vicente, the director of What the Bleep Do We Know, on last March.
Uh-huh.
And reading this book was kind of a simplified version of What the Bleep.
Yes, yes, I agree with that.
It, you know, What the Bleep was incredible, and Mark Vicente was one of the most wise men I've ever spoken with. And yet the film itself takes a number of viewings to really absorb all of it, and yet in your book, you know, it's written in large print and with a lot of illustrations that are a lot of fun, and it brings home the same points as What the Bleep for me in much simpler, easy-to-digest terms.
Thank you for that.
That's
really been the purpose of all of my writings. This is like the fifth book that I've written, and all of them I've decided to try to point to something that is very profound, but to do it in relatively easily understood ways, not really, you know, many, many different appendices and esoteric terms and stuff. I wanted to distill it down into something that's very simple and simply put. And if you'll notice in the book, you know, I have many of these pages, these images are back-to-back, so like on one of the pages, I have images of like the Dalai Lama and Ramana Maharshi and who else? Mother Teresa, and they and their images are literally coming out of this void, this hole in the center. And then you turn that very page, and there is Hitler, and there's Saddam Hussein, and there's Osama bin Laden, and their energies, their images are equally coming out of the very same hole. And this is what I was pointing at, that the whole, this void, this emptiness inside, sources it all and doesn't differentiate it, doesn't value one more than the other. And I point out also, you know, along that same line, that take a look at any great Shakespearean play. Shakespeare, I'm sure, loved his villains every bit as much as he loved his heroes.
Mm-hmm.
The villains give the heroes something to be heroic about.
Mm-hmm.
So they need each other. They're like different sides of the same coin.
Right, and the villains also give the audience a chance to connect with certain aspects of their own mind and their own behaviors, too. And
very much so, yes. It gets us in touch with our own debauchery, our own depravity, our own shadowy energies that we push away from and say, no, that's not me. I'm not that kind of person, and yet we really are.
Mm-hmm. On page 71, you have a quote from Henry James that says, everything is nothing. And then your conclusion, so maybe nothing is very heavy. And you have a picture of Atlas with that hole on
right.
his shoulders as he's carrying the world.
Holding nothing.
Right. And so what do you mean by nothing is very heavy?
Well, it seems like a lot of times we look at our lives, and we think, oh, this is so heavy. I'm really in a lot of struggle, and life is weighing down heavily upon us. But I like to go beyond that, beyond the appearances of that, and see what's beyond on the other side of all of this heaviness that you think that there is, and you'll really see this great freedom, this void, this emptiness that all the great spiritual traditions point to. You know, it's like the cross cultural perennial truth that there is only one quintessential oneness with all of this, and everything else is illusory, that things have been laid upon it or superimposed upon it to slice and dice it. But truly, everything is really one. It's all God. It's all consciousness.
And if we were able to apply that amongst the world's religions, obviously there would be a lot less murder and killing going on the planet right now.
Well, that certainly would be wonderful, wouldn't it? But everybody wants to think that they have the exclusive pipeline to the Almighty, and that
right.
their way is the only way.
Mm-hmm.
But they get caught up in their own stories. Because
right.
when you think about it, Buddha was not a Buddhist. Christ was not a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Muhammad was not a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
all that stuff, the story about their enlightenment, came after that by their followers. So they created stories and rituals and dogmas and all that thing, all the stuff that people who now, you know, purport to that particular line of faith, they line up behind it and say that's what it means to be that. But it kind of ignores what the fundamental reality was of Christ's awakening or Buddha's awakening or what happened with Muhammad.
Stuart?
Yes?
Okay, we have a caller, Michael, from Los Angeles that would like to ask a question with you and your guest.
Michael, welcome to the show.
Ah, thank you. This is my first opportunity to tune into your webcast. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Great, thanks. I'm glad you're listening. What's your question?
I have a thought. As I was trying to focus on my question, you raised the idea of Shakespeare, and it brought me to the idea that Dr. Hillig was saying about Shakespeare not really, or the one not really caring whether something is good or bad. It's just simply there to present to you whatever you draw out of it. And I think Shakespeare said there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he? So it's sort of saying it doesn't really matter to the one what you're thinking or what you're doing. It's presenting everything to you, and you make your own choices. But my question was, is this whole with a W in the middle essentially the illustration of the source or the fountain for unfoldment? Essentially, this is where all of our awareness that we unfold is drawn from. Is that really what you're saying?
That is really that's kind of what I'm pointing at, Michael. That this, but I use the 1 inch thing. But obviously, the void is not limited. It has no parameters. It has no boundaries.
Sure.
But that there's this matrix, this emptiness, this void of out of which everything bubbles up and experiences, much like. I think on one of the pages I had a cornucopia. Everything kind of comes out of that energy. Everything and nothing, and this is the great paradox, you know, it's the source of all everythingness and the source of all nothingness equally at the same time. And the reason why I did that was because I wanted to kind of leapfrog over all of the descriptions that people have used, including myself, in pointing to this. I said, words can only take you so far. Let's actually point to something that's really nothing, and that is the emptiness. And you can hold the book up, and wherever you look through it, you know, that is contained in it. I'm looking right now through the hole, and I see a mountain. The whole mountain is contained in this 1 inch, or I can point it at the sun, or the at night I can point at the galaxies and have the whole galaxy appear within the context of this 1 inch hole. Everything comes out of it.
That answer your question, Michael?
Yes, thank you.
Good, and thanks for listening. I appreciate it, and thanks for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now, in your bio, you said that you were a Los Angeles County probation officer for 7 years.
Yes.
And I would imagine that one of the things that you brought into your work with probationers, whether it was with juveniles or adults?
With juveniles.
Juveniles.
Yeah.
Was this philosophy and this energy, I mean, how did you help apply this to such, you know, very often very disturbed juveniles?
Well, I was lucky. I was working at one of these probation camps. So I would be working like a 56-hour shift straight, and then I would have 4.5 days off and back and forth. So I had some time every week to deal with these kids, and I would invite them into a meditation group, during which time I would give them some specific exercises and actually do some astral projection. And they were all very willing to do this because they didn't like to be locked up, obviously, and
mm-hmm.
they would kind of imagine themselves going up and going away from the camp and going down to Los Angeles and visiting their girlfriends and their
mm-hmm.
their families and so forth. And I remember one time, it was, I don't know, everything seemed to be aligned just right, and the kids had a difficult time getting back in their bodies. And I finally had to say, you've got to come back in right now, because if not, I will not allow you to come in, you know, next week. And then they started to move and stuff. But they were so far out of that
mm-hmm.
and really in a place where they were so relaxed. And I think what it was it created an opportunity for them to really fully experience deep down that they were not their bodies, that they had a body, just like you have clothes, you have a car, but you're not that. And that one realization, that one possibility, could be a real opening. It'd be interesting to see what kind of long-term effect this had had on the kids, and but that was like, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Right. Well, I think also, because I worked with youth back in Florida in a drug abuse treatment program and worked a lot with youth and adults on probation and parole. And one of the things I would imagine that you were giving them is a peaceful place inside that nobody ever introduced them to before. That
yes.
felt, that probably made them feel like they were home for the first time in a long time.
It was a sense of safety, because we mm-hmm. went to a separate room and we had the door closed and I had some music and I put some candles and incense. It was amazing, really, when I think about it, that they allowed me to do that in Los
uh-huh.
Angeles. But they did at that moment and at that time. So I really created a safe space for them to let down all of their machismo, their macho, their bravado, their posturing, because they were with the Crips and the Bloods and all of the gangs and stuff. But inside this space, inside the classroom that we dealt with, they put all of that stuff down.
And all the defense mechanisms.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So. And mm-hmm. and so they really had a deep experience of something that they had never had before, and it was a taste that they liked, and they wanted it again.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that I would come into the parking lot for the new shift, kids would be waiting for me at the other side of the fence, yelling out their names, sign me up, sign me up.
Uh-huh.
So I knew that I was having some kind of, real effect on what was going on there.
Well, basically, you were bringing them into the here and now, and that's another thing I want to talk about. And I'm going to read on page 98, your fear and anxiety are created whenever you act as if there are other realities that are somehow more real than this one is right now. When you allow your mind to dwell on the painful past or to scare yourself about the unknown future, you're moving your attention into areas where you have absolutely no real power to affect anything whatsoever. The one place where you have any real power at all is always and only in this present moment of now. Your entire life is unfolding from this precious instant because you can only live on the very crosshairs of here and now.
Right.
Talk about how important that statement is in terms of people's journeys, but also where does that play a role in the work that you do?
Well, I think it makes a very profound impact when I tell people. I say, because they admit, I think a lot about the past, and I have a lot of regrets and resentments and anger and guilt. Or I tell myself scary stories about the future, about what could happen, and all the imaginings that I have down the road. But I say, all right, I'll tell you what, take a breath in the past, or take a breath in the future. And, of course, they're immediately stopped because they cannot breathe at all in the past, nor can they breathe in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I remind them they can only take a breath in this very moment of now. This is the only moment that they have any kind of power over. In that when you're thinking about the past, where are you? Well, you're in the present. When you're thinking about the future, where are you? Well, you're in the present. So the present sources the past. The present also sources the future. And whenever the ego goes away into that, it starts to tell stories. Stories about what happened and what should have happened and what could have happened and what might have happened. Or out into the future about what might be coming around the corner that's scary. But it disempowers you. It takes the power away, and we get hooked up in on the story of who we think we are. And I remind people, I say, you need to let go of what's already gone. Instead of clinging on to it, let it go and touch life very lightly. To be in a place where you are arriving and departing at that very same moment, not to arrive and cling, but to live life much like you're playing a piano. You're on it, you're off it, you're on it, you're off it, you're on it, you're off it. If you don't, you're like poor Johnny One Note, over and over and over, playing the same chord over and over.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, if you live your life out lightly, then you can better play the song of God that you are.
Mm-hmm. and very often to put it, see, everything you're talking about, I think if there are other therapists listening to this who maybe aren't comfortable dealing with the spiritual aspect of a client's needs and their journey, the words that we're using may be spiritual words, but they actually translate into the very things that we do in psychotherapy all the time. What you just described is when people live in certain patterns that are informed by things that happened in the past.
Right.
And their anxiety in the present is informed about the sense of hopelessness that nothing else can happen other than a repetition of those same patterns, and life is never going to change.
That's right.
And so everything you're talking about and putting in more metaphysical or spiritual terms are the very basic foundations of what psychotherapy is about.
Yeah, that's true, Stuart. You know, a lot of times people think there's a big gulf between these two, and they're really not. You know, I think we're talking about the same thing, but different aspects of it. And certainly, like, for example, the beliefs that we have. I believe that we live our life out into the beliefs we have, and the expectations and beliefs about the world that we have will just mysteriously shape the things that show up in the path of our lives through the beliefs that we have. And this is seen over and over. I mean, for example, if I believe that most women will betray me, I'm going to find myself involved with and attracted to women who either will betray me or who I can consciously or unconsciously train to betray me.
Right.
So I can set myself up to make myself right, because the universe wants to make whatever I believe, no matter how crazy or off the wall it might be, the universe wants to support that. And so it'll provide me with the evidence and the proof that I can say, aha, I knew it all along. Women are that way, and that I can feel righteous about it and justified in my anger about them or any other kind of acting out behavior that I might have towards them.
Mm-hmm. And it feeds back into one's ego sense of identity, which is one of victim and abandoned person, an angry person, hurt person, and, you know, walk through the world playing for sympathy.
Oh, that's such a big factor these days. I think it's when I look around, there's such a an energy around that seems to, we want to victimize ourselves. But I remind people that come in and talk to me as clients, I say you are 100% responsible for everything that you think, feel, say, and do. Not 99% responsible, 100% responsible. So that means nobody is doing it to you. Nobody is making you angry. Nobody's hurting your feelings. And nobody's making you happy. You know, happiness is a choice. Abraham Lincoln said people are about as happy as they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
We do this to ourselves, and we need to recognize that our hands have always been on, are now, and will continue to be on the steering wheel of our own lives. Nobody is driving us around, and we can feel, oh, poor me, they're doing it to us, because that takes us off the responsibility hook of doing something now to change that, and instead waiting for them to change, for the world or situation to be different than what it is, and we can feel okay and justified in staying stuck and not doing anything about it.
Well, I'm going to ask you to apply that to a very big picture right now.
Okay.
Because, you know, as we look around at terrorism in the world and the homeland security issues and 9/11 and all of this stuff, and people can clearly say they're doing that to us. You know, they attacked us, and we have to prepare for the next attack. How do you apply what you just said to people's perception of us being victims or this country being at the effect of the terrorists?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because, you know, from their point of view, we have been victimizing them. So
that's
it
right.
Really is it's a point of view, it's a perception, and who is right and who is wrong. Everybody has their point of view, and everybody has the desire to make themselves right and to have their point of view prevail. So what is the answer to that? Who is... How do we deal with this? Well, I think that we need to do whatever we feel and compelled to do. And I tell people, if you feel like getting involved with Homeland Security, or if you feel like saving the whales or working with HIV or helping the starving kids or working with the earthquake or tsunami victims, you need to do that 100%, and you need to throw yourself into it. However, At the same time, you need to let go of your idea about what the results of all of your efforts are going to look like. Things always work out when you give up your idea about what working out looks like.
Mm-hmm.
If you think, oh, I know what it looks like, it should look like, it should look like this. Well, no, it should look like exactly how it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we need to align ourselves with. It doesn't mean we shouldn't see some kind of what we consider to be wrong or something unjust, and we need to, you know, we feel compelled to go and straighten that out. Throw yourself into it. Don't resist it. Don't resist your resistances, you know, to what you see, but always have as your final default position, it has to be the word yes. See, you say yes to all the things that are happening that you like. You say yes to all the things that are happening that you don't like, and yet you take action. So you take, you say yes to the fact that you're saying no to it and taking action, but you let go of the results and your desire for specific results.
Well, that gets us into the issue of detachment, you know, because basically what you're encouraging people to do is get fully engaged and involved with life and what's going on in the world, and at the same time remain detached from it. And again, I want to read from the book, if you don't mind, page 21 and 22, and it's something to consider, it's titled, "Just for a Moment, Do You Think That You Can Let Go of Your Concepts, Your Philosophies, Your Beliefs, and Your Opinions, and instead detach yourself from all of your thoughts? Can you go beyond your religion, your dogmas, your rituals, your myths, and all of your traditions? Can you learn to simply drop the title and the positions that you play out when you go to work every day? Can you just for an instant let go of all the many familiar roles that you have in your own family? Is it possible to totally detach yourself from being the star in the story of who you think you are? Well, try it. Just go ahead and drop all of your many attachments. Yes, all of them. Let them go. But, you might object, if I'm not my story, then who am I? Well, who do you think you are? Maybe we should just go down the list of the usual suspects. Are you, for example, your mind? Well, not really. Your mind is only an ongoing stream of thoughts that appear to be generated by a particular point of view that acts like a kind of doer. Well, are you your ego? And that's what that famous quote that I said before, ego is just software that likes to believe it's hardware. And you go on, are you your body? And it says, no, you're not your body. And then who am I? So basically what you're talking about and what those pages, I think, talk about is detach from who you think you are. You're not your body, you're not your ego, you're not your mind. And that means that the things that you're doing, if I understand it correctly, are not an extension of your body, your mind, but actually being in the here and now again and living your life in the moment, engaged, and not holding on to the expectations that most of us usually have in terms of what we're going to achieve.
That's right. When you talk about detachment, a lot of people misunderstood that word. They think, oh, then you're not involved. Yes, you can be totally, you can be very detached and very involved with it, but you're not attached to your involvement of it. Like I said, you can, you know, contribute to helping stop the spread of AIDS or feeding the whales or whatever it is, but you're detached from it. You're not really attached to the results. It's the attachment to the results that becomes really the bondage to it.
Mm-hmm. So with that, what's an example of a tool that you can suggest to people in terms of getting out of that attachment mode?
Well, by becoming a student of your own mind and take a look at what it is that you are demanding of life. You know, and we make demands of life. We have lots of shoulds. Life should be this way. Life should not be that way. But we're not really aligning ourselves with life. We're, in a sense, going to war with life. But if we go to war with life, life kind of goes to war with us. Instead of doing that, if we say yes to how life is, then we're aligning ourselves to whatever is showing up. As I put in the book, every time you argue with how reality is, you know, you're going to lose. because reality is as it is. Life is as it is. Mm-hmm. And part of having an authentic life as opposed to a safe life is getting with what is. And from that space, you have great power because you can only change truly from where you're at. You can't change from where you're not at. So I encourage, and this is where the truth-telling comes in and why it's so important in our line of work, when people align themselves with and really tell the truth about what's so for them, mm-hmm. in the telling of that truth, it creates a space then for them to go on and to unfold in some other way, but they're not going to change unless they start from what's really so.
Something I talk about very often on here is a simple tool, actually, because I agree with you. That's the premise of Tell the Truth Faster. And if you want to make changes, you need to become increasingly more conscious of what those basic beliefs and thoughts are that are driving you into behaviors that create your unhappiness.
Right.
So a very simple way to do it that I often suggest to people is just make a list. You know, life should be.
Oh, yeah.
And finish the sentence and write it again. Life should be. Life should also be. Get that list. Free associate. You may end up with 10 things. You may end up with 10 pages, you know. And it will bring up your subconscious beliefs about what you think is true about life.
Yes, that's so true, Stuart. And I think that people have a difficult time with that because they're unwilling to face the harsh realities of life, the givens of life, the stuff that was in place long before they ever showed up. And for example, they think that life should be fair. But life, you know, in many ways shows up in ways that don't seem to be fair. And another reality that they have a very difficult time in getting their arms around is the realization that there are no guarantees in life. You could be doing everything right and correctly and still get hurt. But there's, you know, absolute certitude and risk-free living is truly impossible. And everything changes and everything ends. And we have to just look at life and accept and embrace life on life's terms.
Well, that's one of the things that you see with a lot of these drive-by shootings and accidental, you know, people being in the wrong place at the wrong time and people not understanding why the person that actually got shot was not part of the conflict at all, but what's called an innocent bystander and a straight-A student and a great athlete and loved by everybody, and nobody can understand, you know, how something like that could happen. He wasn't even, or she wasn't even involved in the gangs and things like that. So how do you respond to that type of thinking?
Yeah, it's, you know, trying to come up with an explanation of that, you know, pales in comparison with the pain when you put that up against, you know, people are devastated, families are torn apart. Yes, and those things are inscrutable. It depends on your willingness to fall back into a position of absolute trust in how things are showing up. Sometimes they unfold, sometimes they seem to unravel, but always there's this upwelling of energies or of things that show up, some of them which we just shake our head going, oh my God, that's so horrible. How did that possibly take place? And yet it does take place. And these are the realities that we need to embrace instead of say, no, this is wrong. This should not have taken place, as if we know what should be taking place. We need to align ourselves with what is taking place and saying somehow, at some level, this is, for lack of a better term, appropriate, or somehow it fits in with this. And I don't know how it's going to play out in the next minute, the next hour, the next day, the next week, the next month, the next year, but somehow this will be useful as consciousness wants to express itself through this tragedy, and it will unfold into something else that will perhaps be equally or far more wonderful than this. Who knows? But the trust of that is recognizing that, you know, it's an unfoldment, and to take one little freeze frame and say, this is awful, is not to see the whole great tapestry of life. It's like looking at one little square inch on a tapestry and going, this doesn't make sense, this is really ugly. But yet, if we pull back into the room and look back at the tapestry, we see how that then plays out into the whole tapestry of the life presented, you know, on the wall of the museum.
Mm-hmm. Well, everything you're saying is great for very enlightened beings, then a lot of people will make that comment and respond like that. So what is enlightenment, and how do we attain it? How do we get to that point of enlightenment where we can handle things like what you're describing?
Yeah, this whole idea about enlightenment, what is that, and do we really want to go there anyway? Enlightenment has, you know, it's a real kind of a strange word. What does it mean to be enlightened? Does it mean to be awake, like Buddha said when people asked him, you know, what are you? And he said, I am awake. Well, I, from where I'm coming from, I think that all that there really is truly is consciousness, and that the great illusion, and then I tell people that my mission on earth is to disillusion you, to help break through these illusions, that you are separate, that there is a separateness. And this is what a lot of philosophies and religions are somehow feed into, this idea that there are separations. But truly, you know, if you look at life very much like everything is consciousness, and that we've overlaid this divisiveness onto life and tried to create different parts of it, like, you know, and the best analogy that I've run across is very much like on a movie screen. There's this seamless white screen, and then we project a movie on it, and it seems like these different characters are moving around and things are happening, but the only reality truly is this white, unbroken, seamless screen, this absolute oneness, even though a lot of action and reaction and tragedy and comedy and farce and melodrama are being projected on it. If we identify ourselves as being only one of these characters, then we will naturally identify ourselves as having the consequences of what this behavior is, of what this particular character is seemingly doing. But maybe the reality is that all that there is this screen. All that there is this consciousness. And we're just consciousness pretending like we're not conscious. We've identified ourselves as being this historical body that had a beginning and has a middle age and will eventually die. But maybe there's something beyond that is really going on. And to go down at that level and to go behind the appearances of form and shape and to see what is the quintessential reality of all that is really stuff that they've been pointing at, you know, with all of the great religions and the great philosophies. I'm not saying anything new here at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just pointing out that there is this oneness, and that truly is what this enlightenment is, and the fundamental nature that you're seeking is the very consciousness that you seek, and you are really who you are looking for. And that's the great paradox.
Say that again.
You are who you are looking for.
Right. I think that's real important to hear. Now, the title of your book is Looking for God. I'm mm-hmm. going to ask you a very big question. What is God?
Ah, what is God?
Well, so we know what we're looking for.
Well, yeah, God has many names. You know, Allah or Buddha or Muhammad or Brahman. What is God? You know, what is this consciousness that we all seek and desire for? Because I think that there's a part of us that is compelled to seek this oneness, and we try to seek it out in different ways. We want to have a profound experience of our own true nature. We desire that, and yet there's another part that pulls us back, you know, because we get terrified of being annihilated, having this personhood that we think we are annihilated in this brilliance of the void and the emptiness of that. So we kind of maybe go up and peek at it, but we're afraid of it. So it's this worst kind of conflict in psychological terms, as you know, approach avoidance. We want it, and yet we pull back from it.
Right.
And we're kind of like halfway caught in between these two, between heaven and earth, or hell and heaven, I suppose, and right in between this, and we try to live out our life at that point. But if everything is all one, then there's no separate one who is enlightened. There's no separate one that's unenlightened. All there is consciousness. All there is God, for lack of a better term. But it's just all one, and we can name it whatever we want. In one of my books, I actually call it it,
mm-hmm.
as a way of kind of jumping over all of the words and the labels and the titles that we give to God. Just calling it it.
And that essence lives within all of us, is my belief, and I get that it's your belief too, that we are all that essence, and we are all part of that essence, and that makes us all connected as one whole, as you
well,
keep saying.
I think that it actually goes even deeper than that. I think that it's not like we're a part of God or that God is a part of us. I think that all that there is really is God, that you and I aren't really even here at all. Only mm-hmm. God is truly here. Consciousness is the only thing that is real.
Mm-hmm.
And when people say, what's reality? I think reality is that which persists in all states, in waking state, in dream state, and in a dreamless state. You know, the thing that doesn't change, that's what's real. And I don't think that God can have parts, because parts imply that something can be added to or subtracted from. And I don't think that there's anything missing. There can't be some of God here in this room and some more of God out there in the kitchen and some other God down the street. You know, consciousness is always presenting itself all the time in front of you, 100%, and that you're always looking directly into the multifaceted face of God. I look around the room and I see, you know, I see a chair and the window and the floor and pictures on the wall. That is consciousness, and it's multifaceted, but it's 100% present all the time. Nothing is ever missing. Nothing is ever being left out.
Right. Now, for my listeners who are saying, well, I thought I was tuning into a mental health show, and why all this talk of God? And basically, we've been addressing that throughout the whole show today. Call it whatever you want, but higher power or spirit or whatever you want, call it love, whatever you want.
Yeah, love is
but,
good.
You know, to me, that is the essence of who we are. And I say to my clients, and I've said it on the show many times, that all of this knowledge is within all of us. And my job as a therapist or as a teacher is to help people clear away all of the static that is between that ego mind and the wisdom and consciousness that they were born with. And that, to me, is the essence of what therapy is about and what every spiritual path is about, is learning to access all of this material that's in all of us to begin with.
I really agree with you at that level, Stuart. And I think one of the great myths that I've found about people who come into therapy is they have this idea that therapy is somehow supposed to make them happy. And it's not about being happy. It's about being who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's about feeling what you feel. It's about being authentic and living that way in the world and to experience and totally embrace yourself, warts and all,
mm-hmm.
you know, totally, and just say, that's who I am, and I'm going to say yes to who I am without demanding that I can figure it out or explain it or, you know, understand it or doesn't make, you know, I'm just going to be with who I am and how I am, and I'm going to say yes to that and all
and
of my wonderfulness and all of my not-so-wonderfulness.
Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of clients, well, over the many years, who will come in for a few sessions, and all of a sudden they're in so much more pain because they're beginning
yeah.
to tell the truth and get
That's
in touch
true.
With their inner truth. And they get angry with me because they're feeling worse now than when they started.
Right.
So very often they stop coming to therapy because it's like, well, this is supposed to fix me and make me feel better sooner.
When they do, when they come in and that happens, I say, well, you may be hurt, but you're not going to be harmed.
Right. Good. We have probably about 7 minutes left, and I really want to talk about, we've talked a lot about your book. How can people get your book?
Well, all of my
And your
books,
other books.
Yeah, all of my books. In fact, the first four, called The Enlightenment Quartet, Enlightenment for Beginners, The Way It Is, the third one is Seeds for the Soul, and the fourth is Looking for God, Seeing the Hole in One. And then I've got a fifth book called The Magic King, but that's really for kids ages 3 to 8. But you can get them at Amazon.com. Just type in my name, and all of my books are listed there, and you can order them through Amazon. And if any of your listeners would want to, and I certainly would invite them to, contact me directly. They can reach me at Chuck@ChuckHillig, C-H-U-C-K-H-I-L-L-I-G.com. That's one of my websites, and the other one is Black Dot Pubs, but it'll link you on over there. Just go to chuckhillig.com or chuck@chuckhillig.com, and you can have a conversation with me at any time. I'm really quite accessible.
Well, I also know that you're about to do something that is very unusual and, to me, very exciting, and that has to do with taking your message across the country in a very unusual way. What's coming up for you?
Well, actually, before I do that, between March and June, I'm going to be traveling throughout India. There's a publisher over there that's coming out with new English editions of all five of my books, and I'm going to be traveling around by train and by car and doing a lot of radio interviews and local and national TV concerning that, those books over there. But when I come back here to California in June or so, I'm going to buy a recreational vehicle. So I don't know if it's going to be an RV or like a motorhome or a trailer, but I'm going to load it up with my books, and I'm going to change my lifestyle. I'm going to go out on the road and give presentations and sell my books and talk to people. On the side of the coach that I'm going to be driving, I'm going to be writing, "Enlightenment, Inquire Within," and invite people to, you know, have a conversation with me and invite me in, and we can talk and see what's going on for them. And I'm certainly going to keep my license active so I can always do therapy too, but I'm going to do this lifestyle change. I'm looking forward to that.
Are you going by yourself?
Yes, I am.
That's amazing.
But I'm always looking for somebody who would want to travel with me, so if anybody says they'd like to come along, and after reading my books, they go, yeah, this sounds like it's a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, come on along. Let's talk about it.
Actually, when I've traveled through Europe and even around the country here, I really like doing trips by myself because I tend to step out of my comfort zone more and start talking to other people and meet other people and make friends instead of staying attached to the hip with the person or people I'm traveling with.
Absolutely. I did that too. I was gone for 10 months in 1988, and I traveled by myself and went through like 15 different countries, and I did it for the same reason and had the same experience. It got me out into the community, into the marketplace, into dialoguing with the people that were in the country, much more so than it would have been had I been traveling with somebody. You're
right.
Absolutely right.
Well, definitely, because I still have friends that I made on my first trip in 83 to Europe that I took by myself, and there are still people that I'm very close to today from that very trip.
Yes, for me too. That's great. We've had a lot of similar experiences there.
I think so, yes. Yeah. Well, it's all one mind and one experience, right?
Yes, it is.
Final words. What do you really want to leave people with? We have about 3 minutes left.
Well, I want them to, first of all, enjoy life and to sing and dance in a celebratory way, and to recognize that, hey, all of the stuff in your life is an answer that you've come up with. Is, you know, we're always asking ourselves, what do I need to do in order to wake up? How do I need? Well, what you need to do is what's present in your life. That's the answer to that question. If you want to know what you need to do and in order to get enlightened, in order to get awakened, look at what's going on in your life. That's the stuff that you brought on the path of your life that's there. It's not meant to punish you or to hurt you. It's there to awaken you. It's there to teach you. It's there to show you something about yourself. So all the people who are listening, I invite you to become more of an appreciative audience to your own stuff. You know, instead of saying, oh, this shouldn't be there, no, appreciate it. Appreciate the positive, comfortable stuff. Appreciate the not-so-positive, painful stuff. It's all there for your unfoldment. It's all there for your edification. So revel in it, you know, bring it on kind of mentality, and throw yourself into it and have a great time with it, and encourage other people to look at life that way and to sing and dance along the way. And remember, the purpose of a dance is not to arrive at the final position. The purpose of the dance is in the dancing of it. The purpose of a song is in the singing of it. So sing and dance and enjoy every moment and appreciate what the wonders of what's showing up for you.
Well, usually I give a closing thought, but you just said everything in a most perfect way that I'm not going to dilute that at all.
Thank you, Stuart.
Chuck, I really want to thank you for taking time on your Saturday to join us today.
I appreciate that so much.
And I want to thank my listeners and Michael for calling in from L.A. and invite you all to join me back here next week when I'll be back with Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM, 1310 a.m. in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
That I heard of once.